Board is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Kenneth Mackbar on behalf of Appellees. It's my pleasure to introduce to the court Paul Rowe of Wachtell, Lipton, Roseman, Katz. Mr. Rowe has been admitted pro hac vice, and with the court's permission, will be making argument on behalf of Appellees this morning.
Welcome, Mr. Rowe.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Candace Toll of Richards, Layton, and Finger, counsel to appellants in the action. I'd like to introduce Mr. James Quinn of Wild Bachelor Manges, who has been admitted pro hac vice before this court and who will be making the presentation on behalf of appellants this morning.
Welcome, sir.
May it please the court. This is an appeal from a judgment for judgment on the pleadings in which the vice chancellor below effectively, affirmatively granted to the plaintiff over $1 billion. It was done with no discovery, no depositions were taken, no documents were exchanged, and it was based on what we believe premature determinations with regard to the facts that were well pleaded. And it was done because the vice chancellor, we believe, improperly looked at the pleadings and actually drew inferences against the non-moving party, the Vendi, in such a way as to conclude that, as a matter of law, there was no conceivable set of facts upon which we could win. He did so by asserting that, in his view, the pleadings were vague and conclusory and insufficient to support a claim. But I think, as Your Honors have found a number of times, even vague allegations are well pleaded so long as they give the other side notice of the claim. And here, we believe that our allegations were not vague. They had perfectly clear notice as to what our claim was with regard to the parties' agreement. We pleaded that the parties agreed that there would be tax distributions with regard to the common interest, and we pleaded that the parties did not agree that there would be tax distributions with regard to the preferred. Notwithstanding what we believe to be clear pleadings, that there was no confusion, that the other side clearly understood below, in the context of the arguments made, what our position was, the Chancellor, the Vice Chancellor, chose to grant the plaintiffs judgment on the pleadings. Members of the court, all we really want here is to have our day in court, a chance to show that, in fact, our side is right. We know that that may be a heavy burden, but we, having been thrown out of court at the pleading stage, have had no opportunity to develop the facts, which we believe will show that both that this contract is ambiguous, and that therefore you're allowed to go outside the record and look at the parole evidence, and that in any event, in all events, there was a mistake here that should be rectified. The fact is that the contract simply does not reflect either the party's intentions with regard to these tax distributions or what the parties actually agreed. We believe that the Vice Chancellor improperly looked at two reasonable interpretations and chose one. And at the pleading stage, that was improper and was, in fact, reversible error. The background with regard to this transaction is detailed in the pleadings and in the opinion below. Complicated transaction involving a joint venture, $12 billion deal being put together, both sides bundling a bunch of assets, frantic two-week negotiations, drafts going back and forth. We think that based on what we pleaded with regard to the prior negotiations, with regard to what happened right after the contract was signed, and with regard to the disclosures that were made and not made in connection with these tax distributions, we have pleaded sufficiently that both that the contract is ambiguous and that there was either unilateral or mutual mistake. We believe that when anyone looking at this deal would see that their interpretation of this agreement does make no economic sense. I'm not going to belabor the argument relating to the double dip. We think it's clear that in fact, if you read the contract the way other side would have you read them, they will get more than what the parties agreed to what they were supposed to get with regard to tax distributions and with regard to the whole deal. But let's focus first on the ambiguity. What we have said is that if you take the key provision, Section 802, it is internally inconsistent. It says, on the one hand, that tax allocations of taxable income will be made pursuant to Section 702. The problem is that Section 702 doesn't allocate taxable income. It allocates net income, something that is very different. It's definitionally different. Net income is a niche cap defined in the agreement. Taxable income is set forth in point 703, not 702, and the distinction is clear. In fact, when we did the calculation, there's a difference of somewhere between $175 and $205 million, whether or not you use taxable income or net income, taxable income being the higher amount for the year 1993, and the same would be true throughout the deal. When you couple 802 and 702 together, and that inherent ambiguity, with paragraph 501, which is the section which clearly sets forth all of the distributions that are supposedly to be made with regard to the preferred interest, you have a clear ambiguity, because 501 specifically sets out in three different places the distributions to be made relative to the preferred interest, and specifically names the sections to which these distributions are pursuant to which these distributions are to be made. But what 501 does not include is any reference to any distributions on the preferred pursuant to Section 802. Therefore, if you take these provisions read together, they make no sense. They can't be, without going beyond the document itself, without taking parole evidence, without looking to the history of the negotiations, without taking depositions to find out what the parties did in fact intend, you cannot conclude unambiguously the intention of the parties from the document itself. In addition to that, we also have pleaded that whether or not you find an ambiguity, there was in fact a mistake here. That the parties' agreement, the specific prior agreement which we pled, and we have set forth in a booklet of in front of you at tab C, the precise places where we did in fact refer to the specific prior agreement. The specific prior agreement was that the parties agreed that there would be tax distributions, there would be a tax gross-up, so to speak, with regard to the common interest only, not with regard to the preferred. We set forth that those pleadings clearly in at least three different sections of the pleading itself. And there was no confusion, Justices, on the other side as to what the prior agreement was. If you look at tab D, you'll see that at least five different places in the papers that the other side submitted, they specifically referred to our allegation with regard to the party's prior agreement. They understood what the prior agreement was. It was common only. It was not preferred. That's what the pleading says. And we believe that the Chancellor, the Vice Chancellor, incorrectly applied the Cerberus case, because when you look at what Cerberus is talking about, the key factor in Cerberus is there enough in the pleadings for the court to be able to determine how to reform the contract? And we believe that it is clear and unequivocal that there is enough, more than enough, in the pleadings to determine that the party's agreement was common only, not preferred, and that therefore the basic standard that's set forth in the Cerberus case and in all the other cases that have been cited by both sides with regard to the need for a prior specific agreement, that prior specific agreement has to be enough, whether under unilateral mistake or mutual mistake, to allow the court to be able to reform the contract in a way that comports with the intent of the parties. And we believe that we have, in fact, pleaded a specific prior agreement and the existence of what that agreement was, which allows the court to, in fact, reform the contract in accordance with the party's actual intention. Now, the basic error we believe that the Vice Chancellor made was he went through the pleadings, went outside the pleadings to some degree, and then determined a number of key disputed facts in a way that favored the moving party instead of the non-moving party. And at the pleading stage, that is simply wrong. It's against all of the Delaware Supreme Court cases which say clearly and unequivocally that at the pleading stage, you have to give all of the inferences in favor of the non-moving party. And if you look at the tab A that's set forth in the little booklet that we handed up, what it shows is that the Court of Chancery effectively resolved the core disputed issue of fact, whether the parties intended for the partnership agreement to provide tax distributions on Interactive's preferred interest. And it did so by making the following findings of fact, which at the pleading stage was improper. First, it found that the court concluded that there was no specific prior agreement, even though we had pled that there was a specific prior agreement with regard to the common only, but not to the preferred. Secondly, the court decided the timing of a conversation between Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Hanzo that related to the very discussion with regard to whether or not there would be tax distributions on the preferred. It decided the timing of that, even though there was nothing in the record that, in fact, to this day, shows when exactly that conversation took place. He made a finding with regard to the timing of that conversation, saying that he thought it happened on December 6th or shortly thereafter, even though the only thing that both parties could agree on is it happened sometime after December 6th. Now, the irony of this is that he then concluded from that that it must be that the parties had not agreed with regard to the preferred, and that based on that, he made a determination that the contract reflected the agreement of the parties. Now, the reality is that, and this is one of the things that I think the other side has, I'll call it the ultimate in misdirection, has focused on the fact that there were a number of drafts that went back and forth between the parties. And that in the end, since the language that was ultimately accepted was language that came from the Interactive side, that therefore you conclude from that the preferred weren't intended to be covered. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at what the exchange of those drafts involved, it had nothing to do with whether or not the common or the preferred were covered under that paragraph. What it had to do with was whether or not the distributions were going to be mandatory or not. Therefore, the key question, that is, whether or not they covered common or preferred, was not dealt with at all in the exchange. So the timing of that conversation and the fact that the Vice Chancellor took the timing of that conversation to be so important and then inferred from that the Interactive side was correct in its interpretation as opposed to our side, we believe was an improper finding of fact at this pleading stage. In addition, the court decided that the USA Interactive comments that were made the day after the contract was signed in a conference call with the analysts referred only to deferred taxes. And even though the very next sentence talks about the fact that the amount of distributions was going to start at $60 million. Well, the reality is that if they're right, then the amount of distributions would not start at $60 million, they would have started at $120 million. And we believe that that was ample evidence of showing either that they knew that the agreement was no preferred and that was what both parties had intended, or that they knew that we understood it was no preferred and that they chose not to disclose that the deal was not properly reflected. Either way, whether it's mutual or unilateral, we're entitled to get discovery on this issue and determine by taking the deposition of Mr. Kaufman, by taking other depositions, what in fact the parties actually said and when they said it and what was intended to be reflected in the agreement.
Let me interrupt for a second.
Yes, ma'am.
As I understand it, you are at this point arguing mistakes, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And if we assume for a moment that the contract provision on its face is unambiguous, as the court decided, then the question is not what inferences and so forth can be drawn, but rather whether you've pleaded mistake with particularity, which the court said you did not. And it seemed to me in reading the court's decision that the court was saying, I'm even willing to take a look at some of this evidence that you're trying to present in support of your claim of mistake and extrapolate from that evidence allegations that aren't even in your pleading. Does the court have to go to those lengths when it's your obligation to plead mistake with particularity?
Well, Your Honor, that's a fair question. What we believe we were doing, when you look at the pleading, we pled the discussion between Kaufman and Hanazo. We pled the proxy and the failure to disclose. We pled the statements in the analyst call. We believe, taken together, those support, all of those support and sufficiently support the fact that there was either a mutual or unilateral mistake. What the court below did was to take all those pleadings and then infer the opposite of that, which we believe the court is not allowed to do at this stage. We believe that the court had to accept those allegations that, in fact, on their face, support our position. Instead, what the court did, and I'll use the example of the proxy, where the court actually went outside any of the pleadings and referred to letters that went back and forth to the SEC, and then inferred from that, because we had knowledge of these letters, even though we couldn't comment on them, whether or not we agreed with them, we didn't know about the letters. The court inferred from that improperly that therefore the USA side was right and the Vivendi side was wrong. That's an example of how the court had improper fact-finding in the context of a motion for judgment on the pleadings. To go outside the record like that and make a determination, particularly to take an inference and turn it on its head against us on the pleading stage, we think is improper.
And you've used 2 minutes of your 5-minute rebuttal. Do you want to reserve the rest?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Paul Rowe for IAC Interactive. I heard Mr. Quinn essentially make 3 points, which I think are all dealt with in the Vice Chancellor's detailed and thorough opinion below and in our reply papers. And I will try to address the specific points that he's emphasizing at oral argument, and as to the rest of the issues, we will rest on our briefs and on the opinion below. The first point that I heard Mr. Quinn make was essentially what they call an economic structure or double dip argument, which shades over almost to a kind of unconscionability argument, that the amounts of money here are very large and that it couldn't possibly have been their intention to sign a contract which provided those large amounts of money to us. And I think the very simple answer to this question, Justices, is that the rules are the same whether a contract has 2 or 3 zeros at the end of it or 9 or 10 zeros at the end of it. These are very large companies. Vivendi, at the time it entered into this contract, had a market cap, it's a matter of public record, of about $50 billion. Both sides were advised by highly experienced counsel. Vivendi was advised by the Cravath firm. IAC Interactive was advised by my firm, the Wachtell firm. And as the court below found, And as he set out in detail the history of the drafting, the provisions here were not boilerplate provisions that were just stuck in the contract. They were provisions that were very carefully exchanged and commented on by the sophisticated and knowledgeable counsel.
Let me interrupt for a second. I recall reading about the various drafts and what was crossed out and back and forth. And it seems to me that what your opposing counsel said was correct, which is that at no point did any of those drafts reflect an issue about preferred versus common. It was all about whether it was going to be mandatory or discretionary. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, those words may be correct, but they only tell half the story, and it's a misleading point by opposing counsel. The fact is that the way the draft was set up and the way Section 802 reads is that it refers to Section 702. It says that tax distributions will be due on taxable income allocated pursuant to Section 702. Section 702, in turn, tells you that taxable income is allocated to the preferred, to the common, etc. So that reading the two sections together, which is how reasonable lawyers would do it, it's perfectly clear that Section 802 was saying that it's going to provide for tax distributions for the common and for the preferred. And there was a dispute, as Your Honor points out, in the drafting as to whether or not those tax distributions were going to be mandatory or were going to be discretionary or were going to be limited by the loan covenants at Vivendi. But
okay, well, let me go at it a different way. If the draft back and forth had crossed out preferred or only preferred or no preferred, or, you know, anything like that, then everybody could understand that, yes, the parties talked about whether it be preferred and common or just preferred, just common. They negotiated about it, and this is what they wound up with. But the fact that the drafting changes had to do with a different aspect of this whole issue, which is no longer an issue as to whether it's mandatory or discretionary, could very well mean that nobody was focusing on whether it applied to both or just common. And therefore, if you look at the whole document and you look at some of this other evidence that's being presented, maybe you do have an ambiguity where it may not seem you have one at the beginning, but when you look at it more carefully, maybe you do.
Let me address that, Your Honor. We have a signed contract that works on its face. The Vice Chancellor said he thought the contract was clear as day. It fits together. It has an integration clause. In order to get past the notion that you're going to read in something different into the words of that contract, you have to show either an ambiguity or you have to properly plead mistake. And for these purposes, let's talk about the mistake claim. They have to allege, to get to first base on a mistake claim, that there was a specific prior understanding or agreement. And they don't do that. What they do is restate and continually restate a conclusory allegation that there was an agreement to just pay on the common. But as the Vice Chancellor correctly said, he does not have to accept and should reject on a pleadings motion mere conclusory allegations. All they pleaded with respect to the existence of an agreement to provide for payments on the common but not the preferred, all they pleaded is on two pages. It's a two-page pleading. You can find it at pages appendix 33 to 34. And it comes down to essentially one sentence. It comes down to the opinion below quotes it, but let me quote it again for the court. During the negotiation of the transaction, Vivendi unequivocally communicated its refusal to accede to that demand by IAC, the demand being a demand for tax distributions on the preferred. Indeed, William Hanizo, Vivendi's then CFO, directly rejected such a proposal from IAC's Vice Chairman Victor Kaufman. That's it. All they do is say there was a demand made and it was rejected. As Vice Chancellor Lam said, there was a pleading of a disagreement, but not a pleading of an agreement. Then they go on.
Well, can't you infer from the fact that if we accept this, that yes, there was a demand for some additional benefit, and that demand was rejected, and therefore the parties came to an agreement and ultimately signed an agreement that included only the common?
With respect, Your Honor, absolutely not. With respect, all you can infer from that was the demand was made and rejected. You cannot infer from that pleading that there was an agreement.
Why shouldn't there be discovery on that issue?
Well, you only get to discovery if you get past the requirements in this jurisdiction for pleading mistake. And there's a very good policy reason for that, which Vice Chancellor Lam sets out at page 36 of his opinion. He said,
Do you agree that he considered matters outside the pleadings, as your opponent has suggested, the proxy letters, for example?
They're not outside the pleadings, Your Honor. The SEC letters that Mr. Quinn referred to are pleaded in our complaint at paragraph 31, and they're responded to in the answer to paragraph 31. And the opinion below at page 45, note 93, discusses the letter, but the letter is there because the parties referred to them in the pleadings, and all the judge below was doing was what's often done in pleadings cases, which is when in a business case the parties plead a document, the court looks at the document and he decides whether or not there are reasonable inferences to be drawn from that document or whether there aren't. And the same way in a case involving a proxy statement, for example, the court looks to the proxy statement on a pleadings motion. We don't consider that to be going over the line and deciding evidentiary issues. The policy issue here is a very important one. As Vice Chancellor said, in order for a dispute centered on the interpretation of a contract to move beyond the pleading stage, a court must find that a contract's terms are ambiguous. If the court finds the terms are not ambiguous, the court will enforce those terms as written, and the case will not move to the expensive, time-consuming stages of discovery and trial. Through this framework, contracting parties are assured that their well-documented agreements will be upheld without significant time and funds expended. In other words, Your Honor, if the mere pleading, for example, of a disagreement at an earlier stage in a negotiation can suffice to allow a sophisticated corporation advised by highly experienced counsel that signs an integrated contract to come back into court and say, you know what, we had a disagreement earlier. It appears to have been resolved on the face of the contract, but we want discovery. We want testimony, and we don't want to have to pay during the interim. If that's the rule, then quite honestly, and I don't like making Chicken Little arguments, but quite honestly, that means that large corporations that use experienced counsel and enter into these complex integrated contracts don't really have any assurance that they're going to be doing anything other than buying into a litigation. And that's why the court has a very important gatekeeper function to play when mistake allegations are made. So that's a long answer to your question, Your Honor, but I don't believe they're entitled to discovery here. And I asked the court to look at folder or this set of quotes that Mr. Quinn gave the court, and I think all you will find in here is a set of conclusory allegations and a set of references to the fact that, of course we use the word agreement in our brief. We were talking about the agreement that they say exists. But the only factual pleadings, the only well-pleaded factual allegations in this case that are not purely conclusory is that Mr. Anizzo had a conversation with Mr. Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman said that it was essential to IAC's deal that he have tax distributions on the preferred, and Mr. Anizzo said no. But that doesn't constitute an agreement. If the court pleases, I'll go on briefly to discuss the other issue, which is whether or not there is, in fact, an ambiguity between Sections 802 and 702. And as our brief points out, this is an argument that was simply not raised below, and in fact, the court asked then-counsel for Vivendi whether or not he was making an argument that Section 802 didn't distribute any money because of the way it interacted with 702. And then counsel for Vivendi said, we're not making that argument. We say that 702 and 802 work to distribute tax distribution, cash payments. And in fact, the record shows that they have been making such tax distributions on the common, and they plead in their pleadings that the quote is, the plain meaning of Section 802 is that it distributes tax distributions on the common. So they pleaded that 802 had a plain meaning. When they were asked in the court below whether or not they were going to argue that Section 802 distributes no money, they declined to make that argument. But then, having lost the motion, they are now asking this court to consider an entirely different theory of ambiguity. As our brief says, we believe that is barred by Rule 8 and by the doctrine that parties are bound by their own pleadings. As to 501...
Let me interrupt.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's say we were to get to that issue nonetheless. What would your answer be?
Well, our answer on the merits is tied into Section 101, which is 101 is the definition section. And the way it works is very simple. Well, I shouldn't say that, because we are in the realm of taxes. And Section 802 says that tax distributions are to be paid on taxable income. But it doesn't stop there. If you read their papers, you would think it stops there. But it says paid on taxable income allocated pursuant to 702. Now, 702 has a phrase and allocates net income, which is a defined term. And so the sensible thing to do is to go to the definition of net income, which is in Section 101 of the agreement. And in Section 101 of the agreement, net income is defined as taxable income with a couple of adjustments. For example, one of the adjustments is to add back in tax-free income, for example, municipal bond income. So the way the two provisions work together is tax distributions are being paid on taxable income as distributed by 702, but you don't say on net income, because, for example, if you said tax distributions were being made on net income, you would be including something that there's no reason to have a tax distribution on, municipal bond income. But all you have to do is go from 802 to 702 to 101, and it's clear as day that 101 distributes taxable income. And one of the arguments they make in their brief is that, well, how can you unpack all these things? How can you untangle them once you arrived at a thing called net income? And the answer is very simple. These are numbers on a page. And when you start out with a number at the top and you subtract something, it's not difficult to figure out what the elements are. In fact, Section 101, well, 101 is all the definitions, but the particular definition of net income uses the phrase constituent elements such as income. Let me briefly find that and read it to you, because I think it's illuminating on this point. Net income
means for any period the taxable income or tax loss of the partnership for such period for federal income tax purposes, and then it goes on to make some adjustments, for example, increased by the amount of any tax-exempt income of the partnership, and then later on it refers to the constituent items of income, gain, loss, and deduction. That's the appendix at A20.12. The parties, when they agreed to this definition, knew that net income had constituent elements, and you could look to the constituent elements if, as, and when you need to. And we did, and they did. And let me tell you when this happened and how it happened. One of the things they say in their brief on this is that after the Vice Chancellor Lam issued his opinion, there had to be extensive discussions and conversations and so forth, and it was, they imply, I think it's fair to say they imply, that it was difficult to figure out, and that therefore that supports their view that there's an ambiguity between these two sections. Well, the fact is that, again, whatever they're saying now, Mr. Finkelstein, Jesse Finkelstein, when he wrote a letter to Vice Chancellor Lam, and this is in the record, it's page B2 of our appendix, the Appellee's appendix, July 22, 2004, he wrote a letter about the form of order, but he starts out by saying, although there is agreement on most parts of the order, including the precise amount of the outstanding tax distributions on the preferred interest due under Section 802. So July 22, 2004, there's no problem figuring these things out. When it comes time for the appeal brief to be filed, there's an implication that it's suddenly very difficult to figure these things out. And we think this is yet another example, like the switch in position as to whether or not real position here is that the contract provides, in its plain meaning, for distributions as to the common or not. Again, a thing on which Vivendi has switched positions from the court below, and our cite to the colloquy between Vice Chancellor Lam and Mr. Warren, their counsel below, is page, appendix page A639. Warren was asked by the court, well, to the extent there is income allocated to the common under Section 702, wouldn't 802, as it's written, require a tax distribution? Mr. Warren, yes, sir. Similarly, they raised the question, it's one of the many places where they try to say the judge below went outside the record, that he determined whether or not the conversation between Mr. Anizzo and Mr. Kaufman occurred on a particular day. Well, they conceded below when it occurred. Mr. Warren conceded. This is appendix A632 and appendix A655. The court below asked, when are you contending it occurred? They said it occurred right after the first draft, and now they're in this court before your honors arguing that the judge went outside the permissible scope of what a vice chancellor is supposed to do when the vice chancellor asked the question and got an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Will.
Thank you, John.
Three minutes, John.
That's close enough. 2 minutes and 50 seconds. I'll just use 10 seconds.
Let me be very brief, because I have to be. First of all, with regard to this issue about unconscionability, we're not arguing unconscionability. These are all, I agree, these are big boys. They can, in fact, survive on this one way or the other. The issue is very different. The issue is, you look at the contract language together, 802, 702, perhaps Mr. Rowe misspoke when he actually said that 702 talks about taxable income, because it doesn't. You look at those three provisions together, 802, 702, and 501, there is an ambiguity. There's a plain ambiguity. It is as clear as day, to quote Vice Chancellor Lam in another context. With regard to your question going outside the record, it's true that the SEC letters are mentioned because they pleaded them, and we simply pleaded that, yes, counsel below received copies of them. But what the vice chancellor did was to then look at the letters and interpret what he thought they meant and make a finding against us based on his interpretation.
Yeah, I understood your point to be earlier that the problem wasn't that there were matters or documents referred to in the record upon which he relied. It's just that those matters on, or documents on which he relied will suffer two different interpretations, and he picked one.
That's correct.
And you're entitled to discovery because there's another just as reasonable as the one he picked.
That's correct. Thank you. You said it much better than I did. With regard to the issue of whether or not this issue was raised below, I would just ask you to look at Rider B with regard to the ambiguity as to 802 and 702. In hoc verba, we raised it below in the context of our reply brief. This is an issue that was before the Vice Chancellor. The Vice Chancellor obviously decided it against us. That's why we're here, because we don't think he should have decided it against us. He should have given us the opportunity to take discovery, to have some depositions, to exchange documents, and in fact, make a determination whether or not what we say the parties' agreement was, as opposed to what they say the parties' agreement was. Oh, one last point, because this is another canard. This notion that my partner, Erwin Warren, conceded the date. If you look at the transcript, I just ask you to look at the transcript, because if you see, you'll read that it was done in a totally hypothetical thing. With all due respect and love and affection from my partner, Mr. Warren, he had no idea what the date is, and he couldn't concede it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.